This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, Grievers. It is your absolute boy, Michael Cruz Kane, welcoming you home to another episode of A Good Cry. Today's talk is with Cheryl Hines, whom I have admired forever as a comedian. She's a star of one of the funniest shows in the history of television, Curb Your Enthusiasm. She has been nominated for a couple of Emmys for it. And, like so many of us, she is also very familiar with grief. On this episode, Cheryl and I talk about several deaths in her life, about the idea of compounded grief, and about a conversation she had with her dear dead friend. I should also warn you that we discuss suicide in this episode, and if that's hard for you to hear about, I get it. I love you. We also get into non-sexual thruples, a few good books, and of course, Orange Sickle. Hard to say, actually. This is A Good Cry with Cheryl Hines. Thanks for listening, and I hope it helps. Okay, the way that we start our podcast, Cheryl Hines, is by asking, how would you describe your relationship to grief?
I have a great respect for grief. And I learned a while ago that pain is the touchstone for spiritual growth. And grief is very painful. I like to think that there is something that comes out of it. I mean, I know there is. And also, you know, you wouldn't be grieving if you didn't love someone. So I have a great respect for it. I think it's a big part of our lives that I like to keep trying to understand more.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think that duality of grief is something that I think is an eye-opener to a lot of people who haven't been through it yet, and something that a lot of people who have been through it can identify with, that you sort of think of grief as monolithically terrible, and obviously it's painful, but there is also room for you to grow and to, metamorphose? Is that too strong a word?
No, it's not. It's true, because it's a learning process, which doesn't make it sound any better. But I think that it helps you connect to the universe, because it is so hard to understand what happens when someone dies. It's so hard to understand it, and there's so much uncertainty around it that you have to accept it, that you're not going to fully understand it until you go through death. But until you experience it, you know, someone close to you experiences it, it's hard to really understand that part of the universe. You know what I'm saying? Is it too deep or too, yeah, go ahead.
I know exactly what you're saying. And just.
Okay, good.
No, nothing too deep for this podcast. Also nothing too shallow, but the
okay, good. I love shallow too, by the way.
I just wanted to restate that idea that that grief is a way of connecting to the universe, and I think that's also so true. And one of the really paradoxical things about it in my life, and I think in the lives of a lot of people in the West and probably everywhere, is that it feels like so isolating for
right.
a lot of people. But it really is, loss is the only thing that everyone will, everyone's going to feel this.
Experience, yeah.
It may not be the only thing, but everyone right. will feel it. And it does put you in touch, even if you don't want to be, with everything that ever was and will be.
Yeah, I agree with that. And there is something shocking about it when you experience it, because you're right, I don't know if it's only because of our education about it growing up, like our culture, we don't really embrace it. We don't really talk about it. So when you do experience loss, someone close to you, it just feels like, oh my God, everybody else, does anybody else see this? Am I the only one that sees this? You know, and everybody's going to work and, you know, they're working out and life is going on. And you're like, oh my God, you guys, does anybody else see this? And you, and it is very isolating, and because we don't go through it at the same time, you know?
And even if you did go through it at the same time, everybody's loss is like, by whatever degree, so different.
Right.
Like there are obviously things that they have in common, but you know, I have, my son died when he was 34 days old. And I was just talking with someone recently who was talking about a child who died at 10 years old. And even though our experiences obviously share some major factors, they're also vastly different.
Right. Right. And I think that too, you know, when somebody is experiencing a loss, it's hard to find the right words to talk to that person and to comfort them because, you know, you can't say, oh, I know how you feel, because you don't know how they feel, you know? But it's also really comforting when somebody reaches out in some way. And when I'm trying to comfort somebody, I usually say, I understand pain. You know, and I know that you're in a painful place right now, because I think that's a true statement. Like, you can't understand what somebody's going through, but you can understand being in a really painful place.
Yeah. It's a halfway point, at least, to be like, hey, I'm coming. This is how far I know to come with you.
Yeah.
And I know I can't go all the way.
Yeah. It is hard, though. What do you suggest when you're reaching out to somebody?
I mean, I guess it's different for everyone. I think for me, the thing that was the most helpful when I was really in the worst of it was not people trying to comfort me, but just to like acknowledge that it was a real thing that was happening.
Yeah.
So a lot of it was like, wow, that's the worst fucking thing I've ever heard. And because that sentence felt so true to me.
Yeah.
It really felt like, okay, so like, even though you'd have no idea what I'm feeling, you are a real person and I can talk to you.
Yeah.
As opposed to like, this will pass, or he's in a better place, or all that stuff where you're like,
God only gives you what you can handle. And it's like,
oh man. Yes.
You're like, okay.
Or it's like,
go ahead.
I know you are trying to say something nice to me,
but
this is ultimately going to make me go, I can't really talk to you.
Yeah. Yeah. Things will get better. Don't worry. It's like, okay. I will talk to you in a year.
One of the subjects that listeners of the podcast ask about a lot, and that we've only had a chance to talk about very little, is suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that you have like close friends and loved ones who have died by suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
I can now. It's complicated, of course. I had two best friends when I moved to LA. One of them I went to high school with in Tallahassee, Florida. And he moved out here. And when I moved here, he and his boyfriend, his name was Paul, and his boyfriend was Eddie. We just became a throuple. Well, not sexually, but they were boyfriend and boyfriend, and I was, you know, like the girlfriend. And we went everywhere together. We did everything together. And about 10 years ago, Paul died by suicide. It was devastating, and it's very difficult when someone decides to take their own life, because it leaves the people around them thinking, maybe I should have done something different, then this wouldn't have happened. And also, people like to assign a reason, you know, and reality is it's something very personal that's going on with that person, usually involving a mental health situation. And we can't really assign a reason or a purpose or why they did it or why we think they did it. But it's painful because they chose to leave us. And usually when someone dies, it's not by choice, not by their choice. So it makes it more complicated and even more isolating and even more difficult to process, I think. And I remember the day that Paul, we had a memorial for him and we drove out to the beach and I helped, you know, organize it. But on the day, I really felt like, oh, I can't get out of bed. I can't go. It's too hard. It was just too hard. I just couldn't. I really felt like I couldn't go. And I talked to my husband, who we were just dating at the time, but he said, it's really important for your friends to hear from you. It's really important for them to hear what you know and what you need to say. And the truth is, it doesn't matter. It wouldn't matter if anybody had called one more time or if anybody had checked in on him one more time, because we were all around him all the time. But it is important to hear that and to understand that when someone dies by suicide.
You eventually went to the memorial.
I did.
And did you speak at the memorial?
I did.
And what was that like?
It was, it was really amazing because we all shared something very special that day. And everybody was nodding their heads when I was talking. It was very healing to know that other people are experiencing what you're experiencing. You know, and I think that's why memorials and funerals are helpful and important, because you're sharing something very personal and very unique and very vulnerable with a group of people. And it's really, you know, once again, it's the spiritual growth.
And at a funeral like that, did it help you? Like, it sounds like the way you're describing it, that the event itself actually, like, you felt good about it. Because I think sometimes those things feel surreal and like it's happening and it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And sometimes it feels like, oh, you know what? I'm so glad that like me and all these people who love this guy are here.
I definitely felt like I'm so glad that we're all here. And at the same time, Paul was... He was a very judgmental person, that if we walked into a party or a room, he could tell you, you know, what's wrong and whose pants are too tight or whatever. So Eddie, his boyfriend, had arranged for his ashes to be floated out. We went to Santa Monica to the beach, and it was sort of a ceremony. But I was thinking, oh, my God, Paul would be... If he saw this, he'd be like, whose idea was this? And, you know, would be criticizing. And so it was. So and my sister and I knew that. And we'd look at each other like, oh, my God, if he could see the, you know, floral wreath that's going out to the ocean that keeps floating back, you know, he would be saying funny things about it. So that it was good. It was really good. It was, you know, difficult, but also helpful.
When people die by suicide, you've already alluded to this, but there's like a lot of complicated emotions for the people who are like friends and loved ones.
Yeah.
And some of those things are, you know, guilt, which is one of the things you talked about. Like, maybe I should have called one more time.
Yeah.
Some of those things can be anger or, you know, I mean, obviously sadness. Can you talk about like the complexity of that after Paul died?
Yeah. I was mad at Paul for a long time. It's so hard to understand. And a lot of times people feel like it gets complicated, right? Because some people feel like death is the worst thing that could happen, which I feel like it's a gift. I think it's part of our existence and who we are. And so when you look at somebody who decides to die by suicide, if you're in the school of thinking that death is the worst thing that could happen, then you probably stay in a very angry place about that person. Because you're like, oh my God, why would you do this to yourself? The worst thing that anybody could ever do. But if you start looking, if you take a giant step back and you think, clearly that person was in a lot of pain for whatever reason. For somebody to get to that point, clearly they're in such a painful place that they think that will help them. Not to say that they're in a better place, but it changed everything. And I don't blame someone for wanting to change everything.
Yeah. I mean, I think that idea, it's like kind of radical to think, not in like a 1980s surfer way, but like, like radical to come to the point of view of acceptance and like love for someone who has done something that, while you in some level can understand it, also like it hurts you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you love them.
Right. And it feels so unfair to you and to the people who are left behind. Like, you're going, now you have to go through their stuff. And I don't know, it makes you angry. Whereas if someone died from a different cause, it probably would make you angry going through their stuff and trying to figure out what to save and who to give this to and all of that. But if it's, you know, like in the case of Paul, it's like, I don't know, it makes you angrier.
Was there a big process of going through his stuff?
Well, Eddie decided that he couldn't really go through his stuff and he didn't want to give any of it away. So we basically put it in my garage. And so every day when I would come home, my garage door would open and I would see like Paul's comforter and his pillows. And I, you know, and at one point I just said to Eddie, I can't. Like, this can't be the solution because it's too difficult. When I open the garage door, that's what I see. It's too difficult. So, you know, what was complicated?
What did you end up doing with that stuff? Did it go back to Eddie or did you put it in storage somewhere?
I think Eddie took it, and I think he asked his parents if he could put it in their house somewhere, you know. But I highly doubt that anyone ever went through it again. You know what I mean? Just because.
Yeah.
And I understand it. And at the same time, I understand it. Like, it's Paul's comforter. So it's like, I get it. I understand that. But I don't know what you do with it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, in terms of like belongings of people in general, I think there's a lot of people have like an inherent discomfort with other people's stuff.
Yeah.
And then knowing that it's belonged to someone who died is also like, ooh, I don't want to get their death on me.
Right.
I think it's like, like a part of that, that it's like, I don't, especially in a culture that's like, oh, we don't die. That's just not something that happens.
Which is weird. Isn't that weird?
Yeah,
because we all
it
do.
Is weird.
That's what's
because
so weird.
Yeah, 100%. Everybody, right. I mean, maybe not Tupac, but everybody else.
It's a normal, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So I do, there is like a, oh gosh, if I get their death on me, if I own have the things of dead people, then I am aware of death and I really don't want that, I think is a very common thing.
Yeah.
And then there's obviously many more layers within this particular story, because it's not just some guy who's died. It's your beloved friend, and Eddie's partner.
Yeah. Yeah. So it gets complicated. And it's hard. That part's hard. I mean, a lot of it's hard, but necessary. And you know, you really have to figure out how to move through it. Did you ever read, there's a great book called Where the Dead Pause and the Japanese Say Goodbye. You ever heard of this book?
I have not, but I should say that I almost never read books.
Well, I was listening to the radio, and I heard the author, I think you used to pronounce her name, Marie Mutsuki Mockett. She was talking about this book that she wrote, and it was about her grief when her father died. And she went back to Japan and was talking to these Zen priests because she was so overcome with grief that she could not move past it. And she was talking to one of the priests and said, I have a hole in my soul, basically, and I just need to know how to close it. And he said, you're never going to close it. It's always going to be there. But the best thing you could do to show your love for your father is to make everything around the hole bigger. So when you think of yourself or someone looks at you, they're not just looking at a hole. They're looking at this giant, these aren't her words at all, but like a landscape. And then this little, you know, this place that's part of it. Because he would not want you sitting around every day waking up and, you know, thinking of him in that way, that he's the whole in your life. And when I heard that, I heard her talk about it, and then I read the book, it really struck me because it made a lot of sense to me.
I think that's a really lovely way to frame it, that it's like you can build within yourself this memorial to that person,
yeah.
But you don't have to be the memorial.
Like
That's part of you forever, but that's not all that you are.
Right.
If you don't want to be, you can be, you have the permission to be other things.
Right. And it's a great tribute to someone who was part of your life that they're still part of your life, you know, but your life is bigger and exciting and more fulfilling because they're still a part of it, you know?
Yeah. And also, I mean, I'm no Japanese priest, but the idea of trying to close it does, I mean, from experience, a lot of people's experience is totally impossible.
Impossible.
Like that hole is there for good.
It's there.
And now you just know that it's there. Just know that there's the hole. And sometimes you're going to want to go down the hole every once in a while just to see what's down there.
Yeah.
So you know where it is.
Yeah.
And sometimes you'll trip and fall in it a little bit.
Yeah.
But that's part of you now.
It is, yeah. Exactly. So I think when you're struck with grief, it's so hard because you don't have perspective. You're just overcome with these feelings. But it's nice to know. It's nice to, it's very helpful to talk about it when you're not struck down by grief, when you're clear thinking and it's like, okay, I know that it's a process. And the people that are, you know, being struck down by grief, all you want to know is when does it end? When is it over? When do I feel better?
Yeah.
When do I stop feeling like this? So I think this was helpful to know that that person is now a part of you in a different way. So you just have to spend time integrating them into your life in a different way than they were.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
In terms of things being different, you said that you and Eddie and Paul were like a throuple.
Yeah.
So how did Paul's death affect your relationship with Eddie?
That's such a good question. It's such a good question because Paul and Eddie used to come over to my house almost every day. And after Paul died, Eddie didn't want to come to my house because he felt like it was too painful. That was hard, too, because my daughter was relatively young. She was probably about 10. So I needed to be at my house, you know. I couldn't just meet Eddie every day somewhere. So it was always great because those two were always, you know, helping me make dinner. We would watch movies or play games or whatever, but they were part of our everyday life. So it was hard because after that, Eddie really had he had such a difficult time trying to reconnect to who he was, the person that he was without Paul. He had a very difficult time. Didn't want to, actually. So that was hard.
Does that like affect your relationship forever from that point on?
With Eddie?
Yeah.
It did because I wasn't in a place where I could, not this sounds bad, but it's the reality that probably most people experience. Like I wasn't in a place where I could take time off from the rest of my life, you know, take time off from my daughter or from work to just, you know, stay in this place being overwhelmed with grief, that it's immobilizing. I couldn't stay in that place. So for me, I had to be strong for my daughter. I had to be strong for work. I needed to figure out how to cope with it. And Eddie, you know, had spent so much time with Paul and didn't really have a 9-to-5 job, and he was experiencing it differently, and he needed to stay in that mind space. So it was hard because I wasn't able to connect with him in that way. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense, and I think I understand what you mean by feeling like maybe it's not the best way you could have felt or you know, whatever. But I think that is very real, that it's like having a daughter, I think, is one of, or having a child of any age almost, is enough to be like, okay, well, I have to keep moving in a particular direction for this person as much as I want to reach out in other directions as well. But there's a way that I'm headed and I have to keep going that way.
Right. And it was hard for us to meet in the middle because Eddie didn't want to do any of the things that we did with Paul. So that was hard because, you know, you set your life up in a way that you do things with your friends that you love to do and that sort of help you in every day. And I don't know, it was hard.
Well, it's also like, with really close friendships, or well, any relationship, I imagine if it's the three of you that there's like sort of roles that each of you play and your social interactions that like, you know, I'm person A and he's B and he's C. And then when that C person isn't there anymore, that it can be very difficult to replicate. I mean, obviously for a million very understandable reasons, the dynamics that were there before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And also because like, you know, for each of you, Paul's death may, like being together may at some points be like, oh, like a great memory to laugh and talk about this thing that Paul used to do.
Right.
Or the complete opposite of like this totally unbearable pain.
Right. And that's what it was to Eddie, a totally unbearable pain. But my sister was also very close to Paul. And my sister and I, we have more of that you know, it's, we like talking about Paul and all of his flaws, because that's what he would be doing about us. So, you know, to be able to laugh and stuff like that. But yeah, Eddie, tragically, within a year of Paul dying, Eddie died suddenly. He had a heart condition and his heart just stopped.
A heart condition that he had had a long-standing heart condition?
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, I have a lot of friends who say that he died of a broken heart because he was so attached to Paul. That was also, you know, being struck down by grief. I just couldn't believe it when I got that call. I just couldn't believe it. So it was quite a year.
That must be also incredibly complex, like the feelings of Eddie dying as well, especially based like the things you were just saying about how, you know, you felt like maybe you didn't have the right quote unquote feelings about how to interact with him.
Right. Right. Because I also had those feelings of, oh, I should have done something differently. Like, how could I have saved Eddie? You know, you feel like that because it's, I remember that night, his friend called me. Eddie lived in West Hollywood, and I drove over to Eddie's apartment and met his friend there. And for whatever reason, I don't smoke. Well, I smoked. We went to a bar, and I, like, chain smoked all night. And then I just went home and threw up for a few hours. And I was like, wow, that's how I grieve. That's cute. that was a night.
Yeah, I mean, so I think sometimes stuff like that, I don't know if this is what was going through your mind on a conscious or subconscious level, but I do feel like sometimes with things like that, you're like, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to punish myself.
Yeah.
I'm going to do something that I know is going to make me feel terrible for a little bit.
I didn't even, whether you're doing that consciously or not, you're probably right. Yeah.
Those feelings of, could I have done more? Right, that you have both with Paul and with Eddie. Do you no longer entertain those thoughts, or are those still things that come up where you're like,
well, it's
stop thinking this?
Well, it's interesting because I went to therapy, you know, and my therapist said, what exactly would you have done? It's like, well, what if I texted 10 more times that night? And she's like, and do you think that would have made a big difference in what was going on in Paul's mind? You know, so when you can talk through it in a real way and you can get perspective, like, oh, and would going to lunch with Eddie have changed his heart condition? It's like, okay, you don't have to be right every time. But you know, it makes you understand it more and like, oh, I see. I'm having these feelings. Feelings aren't facts. I'm having these feelings and they're normal. And a lot of people feel this way. And, you know, at the end of the day, I know in my heart that was very good friends to them and they were very good friends to me. And I'm positive that more texting and phone calls wouldn't have changed the outcome.
I'm just speaking from my own experience and relating to this. When my son died, he went for like a tragic turn. He was in the hospital, he was in the neonatal intensive care unit, and we sort of thought he was going to come out. Like, we were like, you know, he's going to be better soon.
Right.
We got a call, and very quickly things had flipped.
Ugh.
And for years afterwards, a thought that you have on a pretty regular basis is like, if I hadn't gone home from the hospital that night, if I'd been there, and obviously, like, he's at Columbia, he's not in like, you know, he's not being treated by some doctor in the back of a van or something. He's got the best medical care available in the world. Like, what am I, idiot comedian, gonna do that a doctor wouldn't have done?
Right.
But I will also say, I can't wipe that thought out completely. I can't. And part of that is guilt.
Mm.
And part of that is maybe also the belief in my own specialness that is too strong. That's like, oh, I would have seen it. Somehow I would have known.
Right. Well, that's what.
But it's hard to ditch it.
Right. That is, for me, what therapy is helpful with, where it's like, okay, just because you care so much is not going to change the trajectory of fate or what's happening. It's like, yeah, but I'm so much stronger than that person, and they probably need me to. It's like, okay, settle down, relax about yourself. And then you're like, oh yeah, I guess you're right, you know. So it is hard. That's hard to overcome, if that's even possible. But it's probably also part of your grieving process, also trying to assign a reason. I mean, even what you're talking about, you're trying to assign a reason for it. And you think the reason is you. That's pretty self-grandioso, if you ask me. Because it's hard to just imagine that something would happen so awful. And what's the reason? You know, was it this person's fault? Was it that person's fault? You know, my brother died from a heart attack, and my sister-in-law was with him. And I know that she has these feelings of, oh, I should have done something different. It's natural, but I'm sure it's part of the process for whatever reason. And I think it's helpful when you hear other people talk about it, because when you hear someone else talk about it, it's probably logical to you, where it's like, oh yeah, a few more lunches would not have changed things. If you weren't a comedian, it wouldn't have changed things. Even if you were, I don't know, you could be, you know, whatever, you could be the president, and it would not have changed things, you know. So when you hear other people talk about it, you're like, oh yeah, that's crazy. If I would have only grown up and been a lawyer and knew how to do this and this and that, then I could have. It's like, okay, settle down. It's not you. Yeah. But
I think that's really great for the people who listen to the podcast also to know that, like, these feelings are very common.
Yeah.
Of like, this thing that happened to someone I love, that's my fault.
Yeah.
And I think that it's very normal to feel that way. And, you know, hopefully you manage those feelings such that you have some control over them and can see, like, through the emotion of it into the logic a little bit.
Yeah. And I think it's so helpful for people who have experienced grief and experienced loss to be able to talk to someone who needs that help. Because even us, the person who's reaching out, gets a different perspective, because like you're saying, if you hear somebody saying that, you realize, oh, you want to tell them that's how you feel, but those aren't the facts. You can take that off of your worry list. But sometimes you don't even know that you're doing it yourself until you hear someone else talking about it, and then it's becomes clearer, you know.
Was there somebody, I know you mentioned your husband, like, sort of got you out of bed to be like, you should go to this service or memorial. Were there other people that you knew that you could reach out to when all these, like, crises were happening?
You know, I'm not necessarily a person that would reach out to someone else about my own pain. And I knew at the time that all of my friends were so worried about me. They were so worried about me because I was so close to Paul and then to Eddie. So there was a part of me that felt like I had to, once again, I'm not saying this is the right way to do it. I needed to figure it out on my own. I remember I read On Death and Dying by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Mm-hmm. And it was very helpful to me because I thought I would get solid answers about things. And just like life, death is, there's a lot of uncertainty that you're not going to know answers to, and you have to get comfortable with that. But one of the things that she said in that book on death and dying, and it was interesting too, because, you know, when she talks about the stages of grief, at first it feels to me, it was like an eye roll, because I'm like, okay, well, this can't be true for every person, so I'm sure I'm experiencing it differently. And then you read it and you're like, oh yeah, I do feel that, and I do feel that. So then you start thinking, oh, so this is a universal feeling. It's not just me. And in the book, she said, you know, that depression is part of what you should be or could be going through, and you have to let yourself do it, because it's not a good time for you to be making decisions about your life, about business, about, you don't need to be making big decisions about things. So if you're lying in bed and you're crying or you're reading or you're watching TV, it's necessary, because that's what you're supposed to be doing. You're not supposed
to.
The next day, you're not supposed to get back out there. You know what I mean? So I was like, oh.
That would be amazing if that book, that's what the book said.
Get back out there. Chin up.
The first stage of grief. Take it on the chin, baby. Here we go.
Get back out there. Oh, God. Show up to work with a smile. Yeah, that would be weird. Imagine how weird that would be. And by the way, I'm sure there are people that the next day they get up and go to work and it's like, this is my process. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
I respect it. Let's make some coffee and get to it.
How has your relationship to that grief affected you, like going through your life? Has grief changed you?
Yes. Grief has changed me, because it's, I appreciate people around me more, and not just because, oh, we don't know when somebody close to us is going to die, not just because that, but you appreciate that people around you have also experienced pain in a significant way that maybe that I couldn't have imagined before. So when I met my husband, I'm married to Bobby Kennedy Jr., and, you know, I lost my friends, and then I lost my brother, Chris. It was very eye-opening for me to appreciate what he has been through, the loss of his family, and not only, you know, his uncle and his father in a very public way, but he also lost two brothers. And I remember looking at him after my brother died and just saying, when do I feel different? When will I not feel this way? And I knew that he had experience, and I could not wait to hear what words were going to come out of his mouth, because he's lived through this. And he just hugged me. And I was like, oh boy, I was hoping for, I was hoping for like a solid answer, but I understood what he was saying. It's like, I love you. I'm here for you. And it's like, okay. But you know, it was like, okay, I hear you. There's no answer. You know,
yeah, that idea of like everybody or, you know, many people are going through something ties back, I think, to something you were saying earlier about how you'd be going through grief and you'd be out in the world and everybody's just doing their regular shit. And you're like, wait, I don't understand. Like, someone I love just died. Can we not?
Right. Can you not
be selling cars today?
Yeah.
Or whatever it is people
you don't
are doing?
Have to go to Starbucks today for your, you know, frap. It's like, let's take a minute. Does anybody see what's happening? And that's also eye-opening, because then you start looking at everybody and you're like, whoa, I'm sure a lot of the people that I see today are going through something extraordinary.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
That person is, they're fetching that frap for their buddy. Or
right.
Whatever, you know,
or to go back to the
awful.
Hospital to visit. Yeah. So it's, you have a different appreciation.
But I definitely remember that feeling of, like, you know, going to a restaurant with my wife after our son had died and the table next to us just having like the time of their lives, like the best night that had ever happened to them.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, if you guys could like, right. not saying this, but right. in my mind, be like, if you could shut the fuck up, that would be so yeah. great.
Have a little respect over here. It's like, yeah. I'm sorry, it's Charlie's birthday. We do what we do on Charlie's birthday. And it's like,
yeah. Or for all I know, they're telling stories about dead Charlie. And it's making, right. you know, I don't really, there's no way of knowing except yeah. that at some point this thing is happening to pretty much everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. You just don't know when. Yeah.
Do you think of Paul and Eddie as being somewhere?
That's
now?
So interesting. Okay. Once again, like to get deeper than probably anybody wanted to. I don't know if I was in a dream state or it felt very real. It felt very real. And after Paul died, I really thought that I would have some sort of sign from the universe from him because we talked about it. We had a code word. The three of us had a code word together. I won't say it here because one day if I go to a what are they called? Somebody who can talk, connect.
Psychic?
Yeah, like a psychic. If this psychic says this word, I'll know it's from Paul or Eddie.
And not from them doing research yeah, on,
exactly.
on you.
But anyway, after Paul died, I didn't have any sign from the universe. I didn't have anything. And it also made me mad. But then one night, and this was after Eddie died, it felt like Paul visited me. I was in bed. And we were sitting in my bed. He was sitting next to me. And I said, do you have any regrets? And he said, this is really hard to explain, but where we are, there's no such idea as regret. He goes, it's not a word people don't talk here. He goes, it's really hard to explain, but I'm just going to do it, tell you the best that I can. People don't talk. He said, as a matter of fact, Eddie doesn't even remember what talking is. Like, it's just a different world and it is beautiful. And it's like, that's not how people communicate. I don't think he said the word people, but it was clear that it was a different, completely different world or state. And I just love the idea that regret is, he almost, of course, you know, I was going to say he was judging me for saying regret, but he, you know, he was just trying to say, yeah, he almost made it sound like that's something that you guys worry about, something like regret, but that's not really what it's all about. That doesn't even show up here. So I was like, okay, interesting. And that was it. That was the only time I've talked to him. And he said he wanted to come talk to me before he forgot how to talk.
Is that something that coheres with like experiences you've had in your life before that? Or is that like a totally unique interaction?
That is a totally unique interaction. I would have never imagine that. And even my brother, I mean, I was so close to my brother, but I haven't had any sort of experience like that with my brother. I've had dreams where I see him and talk to him, but I know it's a dream and I do feel like I'm connecting with him. But this with Paul was just different. It was very specific.
And it felt kind of like real in a
different
way.
It felt very real.
I mean, I've talked about this before, but before my son died, I thought of all that kind of stuff as like, this is like kind Ooh. Of fucking nuts.
Yeah. Like, okay, now, Paul, get back to work and quit talking to me during your lunch break. Yeah.
But since then, and also in talking to people for this podcast, the number of people who say that they have had some kind of an experience, all of them very different degrees. You know, some people like, the bird that's at the park,
right.
I swear to God, I know this is crazy, but I'm like positive that bird is my sister.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
The number of people and the number of feelings I have, nothing so clear as what you're talking about, but the times when I will talk to him, even though obviously he can't hear me, unless maybe he can.
Hey. Mm-hmm.
The it cracks your brain open to the idea that, first of all, that whatever is true to you, that's a level of, that is truth.
Right.
That is like true in its way.
Right.
And also that there are things that are possible that you, just as there is something so horrible that you could not possibly imagine it happening and it happens.
Right.
That, isn't it also possible that the opposite of that is true?
Yeah. I completely agree with you. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, even to that point when I've always been very interested in death and dying, and mostly because of our culture and just how we don't talk about it. But I, even at an early age when I was in high school, I went to see a speaker talk about death and dying. It's interesting to think about now because, I don't know, when you're 17, I don't know what 17-year-old is that interested in it, but...
Yeah, I feel like when you're 17, you don't even know that you can.
No, no. But in my years, it's interesting to me people's near-death experiences and how there are a lot of similarities with a lot of people that say they had that experience, you know, of like everything sort of flooding with light and feeling good and light. And it's interesting to me that so many people have that experience that it makes me feel like, oh, that sounds right.
Yeah.
I mean, how do we know? We don't know.
Yeah. That's one of the things you said earlier, too. It's like something we won't know until we die. And even then, we still might not know.
No, we're going to know.
Okay, all right.
We will know. Then it'll be...
That is the Cheryl Hines promise.
Well, then people will either be like, I knew it. Or they're going to be like, oh, huh, I was afraid of this all along, but there was nothing to be afraid of.
Yeah, I think that could happen. But the other thing that could happen is you could be like, you know, smithereens in the afterlife and not afterlife,
right,
in quotes. Who knows?
We don't know. There's no way to know.
We don't know.
There's no.
But we will.
We will. We will. What
That's the things? Cheryl Hines promise.
Yeah, we will. We will. It would be fun if we all, anybody listening, see, maybe we all need a code word.
Okay.
So between us and all the listeners. If you ever need to communicate something to someone, what's our code word?
Yeah, you got to come up with something. I feel like the pressure's on.
Orange-sickle?
Orange-sickle. Wow.
Well, it has to be something that doesn't normally come up in conversation.
Yes,
so if you,
totally.
So if you were, you know, at a psychic and they were like, the orange-sickle is coming to me, you'd be like, okay, I know what this means.
Okay, I think that in the afterlife, if there is a place where we can all meet up,
yes,
if it works like that, I'm going to be hanging out with Cheryl, and we're not letting anybody in who doesn't say orange sickle.
That's right. And we're going to laugh about this. We're going to be like, oh my God, we were so right all along.
Cheryl, before I let you go, I wanted to ask you if there's anything that you wish I'd asked you or anything that on the subject of grief that you wanted to say that you didn't get to say.
Well, I mean, there's something, and I think that you, just listening to you, and clearly because of who you are, you're a comedian, and you can also experience grief. I think it's so important for people to know that even when they're grieving, you can still laugh about something, because I think people get, you know, you're in such a dark place. And then it almost feels like, oh, is it disrespectful if we are laughing about something else? But it's not. I was talking to Abigail, your producer, one of mm-hmm. your producers.
Yes, the great Abigail.
The great Abigail. We had a great discussion. But we were talking about when Paul died, I have a friend named Maria. And Paul and Maria, they kind of always bickered and didn't really get along. And we were in the car driving to Santa Monica, and Maria was in the car with me and my sister. And we're talking about Paul, and Maria said, you know, Paul didn't even like me. She's like, what am I doing? And we called her the reluctant mourner. So she's like, yeah, I'm reluctantly going to mourn Paul. And it makes me mad, and he would like that. But, you know, we could laugh about it because, first of all, she was right. And, you know, it's just part of – that doesn't mean that we didn't miss Paul anymore than we were already missing him. And it didn't mean anything other than we're here with Maria and we're having a moment with Maria, and that's good too.
Yeah, and I think in the absolute, like, worst moments of it, acknowledging reality in and of itself, that's almost funny. Like, just the fact that, like, this fucked up thing has happened and you also have to be at work on Monday, like, that right. in and of itself is funny.
Right, right.
I'm a comedian, so I'm writing comedy, so it's like I'm gonna something terrible is happening, and then on Monday I've got to figure out, I know there's, like, these jokes we got to write about whatever, dinosaurs right. or something. It's right. like, this is absurd.
Right. It's absurd. And it is funny to be able to say, okay, I guess I'm writing a dinosaur joke. And and that's life, you know? It's just yeah. like, but you're right, to be able to acknowledge. I mean, it's just like the ashes and the floating flowers for Paul's memorial. It's like, okay. And I think that's common too, people that are scatter ashes and things. It kind of never goes right. And it's, you know, if you can't just take a minute and go, okay, the wind just shifted. You know, it's okay to say it and to acknowledge it and to, you know, I was at a funeral and there was a bird that they were going to set free and the bird would not fly away. And it was so awkward. The music's going and it's like, oh, God, just, you know, and it's like his soul, the bird will soar. And then it's just like, and then at some point it just like flew like to a car or something. And it was just like, ew, boy.
This is not quite the same thing, but I was at a wedding. And at the end of the wedding, they gave us all these little boxes that had butterflies in them. And you would open the box mm-hmm. and all the butterflies died. They were all dead. So just everyone opening these boxes with dead butterflies in them. It was horrible.
Oh, no. I mean, did people laugh or was it just like, keep it together?
Some people did laugh. Some people were mad.
Yeah.
I imagine that's an expensive thing to have at a wedding.
This is a good lesson learned, by the way.
Cheryl, thank you so much for doing
this.
Thank
you, Michael.
It was a pleasure speaking with you. This has been A Good Cry with Cheryl Hines. Thanks for listening. I hope it helps. A Good Cry is brought to you by Radio Point and HeadGum, with executive producers Alex Bach. I'm talking Sabrina Fonfetter and Daniel Powell. Of course, Richard Corson, and don't you forget Houston Snyder. It is also produced by Abigail Lowenthal and mixed and edited by the one and only Ian Sorrentino.
That was a HeadGum podcast.